It depicts scenes of people, megafauna, yes, megafauna, plants and tools, and it's known to be some of the most beautiful art of its kind in the world. I'm talking here about rock art in the Kimberley. It's dating back at least 10 to 15,000 years, and it can tell us so much about the lives and the belief systems of its creators. Now, researchers have embarked on a new long-term project to learn more about the art of the Kimberley in partnership with traditional owners. Peter Veth has just returned from 3 months of field work with a broken femur, because he's been excavating sites, climbing cliffs, obviously not very well occasionally, discovering hundreds of new artworks and documenting thousands of paintings. Peter is the Kimberley Foundation Ian Potter Chair in Rock Art and a Professor of Archaeology at the University of Western Australia. Peter's on the phone now. Peter, how's your leg?
Oh, look, it's fine. It was a stress fracture and we didn't know until several months in that there was a small fracture there. But yes, I nursed it through and my climbing was fine.
That's great. Tell us, I guess in some part, the fact that you've fractured your leg tells us something, but what is the landscape like where you were investigating sometimes brand new discoveries?
Yeah, look, it's a stunning landscape, the Kimberley, huge plateaus, deep gorges, open expanses against the ocean. It is probably some of the most aesthetically, topographically and biologically, and definitely culturally, startling landscapes in the world. And so as you said in the introduction, the rock art, the symbolic productions of traditional owners, past and present, have survived remarkably well, incredibly well on some of the sandstones in open context for longer than anyone thought it probably could.
I mean, this is Indiana Jones stuff as far as I'm concerned. It's so exciting. It's like a sort of boyhood mystery revealed. I take it you're in partnership all the way with traditional owners on various parts of this country.
Yeah, we actually built this project up with Ballangara traditional owners and rangers. We work with the Indigenous Protected Area Rangers. We have traditional owners coming and going throughout the field, work from a range of communities. And indeed, they hosted a return to country trip to one of the major historic sites in the East Kimberley. And so at one stage, there were 50 people. So yeah, look, it is exciting. These are green fields, a huge amount of work to be done. But the reality is you get up at 4 o'clock in the morning, you start work at 5, and you usually go through about 9 or 10. So that's exhausting and romantic, but just in a very modified way.
No, I get it. I do understand. So in between those hours of waking and sleep, tell us about some of the things that you and whatever a person of that country you're working with have stumbled upon that are actually, well, I can't say brand new. I mean, you use the term greenfields, which I kind of think is amusing, given that it's not really green and in the fact that it was already depicted sometimes 20,000 years ago.
Yeah, that's right. In fact, plants and animals, the landscape have been depicted figuratively and survived longer than virtually anywhere else. Some areas of the Kimberley have been recorded intensively. People have kept strong connections with their art throughout most of the Kimberley, but because of historic dislocation and for a range of other reasons, it's been hard, logistically and financially hard, for rangers and traditional owners to get back. And so we deliberately go out and target areas of concern to the community, sites of great significance, and ones which we think will provide a good statement of values, showing changing depictions of the art along with environmental changes and a whole range of other landscape evolutions. We are talking deep time. We're talking deep history. We are talking in the order of 10 and 20,000 years. But, of course, we come into the contact period. And that's been some of the most remarkable rock art that we saw in this last trip.
As in first contact with Europeans, do you mean?
Pretty well, and contact with other groups. So there were well-documented movements of desert traditions and cults into the Kimberley, onto the Wangina area, and we actually recorded sites that clearly show this desert Kimberley interaction. There are some around the southern Kimberley, but this set of quite extraordinary panels out on the Forest River to the east shows those contacts, we think, in the 19th and early 20th century, and they really are quite extraordinary. So it doesn't have to be old to be special. Some of them are happening during the time of the missions. Others go back a long time.
I just want to disassemble a few of the terms you use there because people might not be familiar. Wanginas, just explain to people what Wanginas are.
Yeah, Wanginas are totemic beings. They're halo headdress figures. They are ancestral beings that actually created the land. They then reside in those rocks and places and leave their image. But it's not just art. It's not static. These are sentient beings. People have names for these Wandjina. They establish clan estates or gra, and they confer a whole range of rights and responsibilities. And part of that is Aboriginal people visiting those sites, painting and retouching that art. What surprised us again, and when I said Greenfields, I just meant that the areas had not been
carefully
or systematically recorded for management or interpretation. There are Wandjinas right out to the East Kimberley, and they're sometimes overprinted with this desert art, but also there were Gwion, or what used to be called Bradshaw figures, all the way out to the east as well. And some of these were right down at flood levels, almost covered by the earth, and others were probably 5 to 10 metres up the rock faces. So you're looking at really quite different, radically altered landscapes and human geographies.
So was that a revelation for you that came out of this trip?
Yeah, there's no question. I mean, we've only just come back. I've still got here in the car outside. we basically could tell straight away that there was a range extension of some of the known distributions of the art, and that was some of the reasons for targeting this area, less studied area of the northeast Kimberley. And, of course, we've got the Northern Territory WA border today, but, of course, that means nothing in terms of Aboriginal shared landscapes. And we think that some of the earlier art, such as the Gwion and the later missing part, straight part, 2-3 colour, what we call bichrome or polychrome figures, did extend right across that area and probably...
When you say right across, Peter, do you mean into Arnhem Land as well?
Yeah, probably Western Arnhem Land, Victoria River District, and probably on the coastal plain, the Bonaparte Basin, which is now drowned. So the ages, which are starting to come through, and they are just being released, big teams who have worked in the Mitchell Plateau now throughout Drysdale, King George and Forest River, Melbourne Uni, UWA, Wollongong, funded by Kimberley Foundation, Vipor, a whole range of people, but Kimberley Foundation predominantly with the Australian Research Council. They're getting dates that show these art bodies would have been where we see them today, but there would have been vast expanses also under areas now drowned, big areas off the North Kimberley coast.
That's extraordinary.
Amazing jigsaw.
Isn't it amazing? Peter Verth is our guest. He's a professor of archaeology at the University of Western Australia. He's just returned from a 3-month trip recording rock art in the Kimberley. And from the way, Peter, you're describing what you've seen, some of those sites would have been known and chronicled either through Indigenous generational history or through some of the work done by academics like yourself in the last couple of generations. But from the way you're talking about it now, this 3-month trip you've just returned from with gear still in the car has actually highlighted how much you still have to discover.
Well, I think that's absolutely true. And I mean, Aboriginal people know their origin histories. The sites they have been able to access and maintain are extraordinarily important. And a couple of the big ones we went to were extremely well known to them and them historically. But doing excavation, starting a new program of dating the art to see how it changes and how there are continuities through time is revealing the fact that we still know very little about these shared art traditions. People like Daryl Lewis wrote really important work talking about some of the similarities in the art in the late 80s, but the dating, the intensive regional surveys, the 5-year program we're starting now, just hadn't been resourced, it hadn't happened. So we're on the era of a whole new generation of research. And as you say, these sites are known, they're part of native title estates, Indigenous Protected Area Corporations, and there's a wonderful new model, I think, of government departments, researchers, managers, traditional owners and philanthropic groups working together to both celebrate the symbolic cultural landscape and manage it. And managing it well is something we really have to do.
What do you mean manage? How do you manage something that's managed to stay vibrant and part of the landscape for millennia? Why do we have to manage it now?
Well, because a couple of things have changed. People left the landscape because of missions and pastoralism, and they've re-entered that now as part of outstations and their own programs. Fire regimes obviously changed. We know from work done in the Western Desert and the Canning Stocker, my colleagues from Penn State who have done, 25 years of recording of firing by Marudu Aborigines and looking at defence, satellite photographs, historic photos plus contemporary practice. We know that those complex fire regimes kept the country in a mosaic. It kept the fires to a softer, if you like, less catastrophic scale. And so the art is testimony to the fact that these fire regimes were sustainable.
Right.
With the movement of people out, changes in fire regime, get more catastrophic. catastrophic events. And we've seen that definitely, say, in the County Stock Group now to the east, where big art bodies have been ripped off the face by late season, late end of year catastrophic fires. And that stuff can be dangerous as potent.
So, Peter, what can be done both culturally and with great sensitivity to protect rock art where there may even be some territorial dispute over who has curatorship of that art?
Look, I think the simple thing is to learn from the past, and that's why I gave the example of the excellent work done on the Canning Stock Route, the traditional communities in Western Desert and the researchers overseas. If you look at effective fire management from the historic record, and then if you reinvestigate that for contemporary landscapes and reintroduce those strategies, which you know, the Kimberley Land Council, Parks and Wildlife, Pastoralists and others are doing, but often in slightly different ways, it's still, you know, a disputed and formative practice.
Yeah.
It's really important to get that stuff right, because as you said quite correctly, the art has survived for a long time. And if you're going to do interventions, it should be based on what works, not experimental.
No, that's right. Yeah. Let's not suck it and see it, because it could be catastrophic. Peter, I think you fractured your leg in the first sort of couple of weeks of being out there. Mm. Despite that pain and just sort of moving through the trip in a mixture of helicopter and obviously on foot, tell us about one of those moments in the last 3 months where you and your colleagues from Indigenous communities, rangers, etc., sort of both had a sort of intake of breath when you came in under an overhang.
We went into an area on the King George River where there were just some stunning, huge Guion panels.
Now, just explain what Guion means. Just explain
these
that.
Are the human figures. They used to be called Bradshaws.
Yes.
There are a range of contemporary terms, but we call them Guion now out of respect for the terminology. And these figures were large. They're almost 1.5 metres high, extremely large galleries. And they were part of larger panels that had later art showing people with really complex pubic aprons and all sorts of ornaments on their arms. And they're actually engaged in, obviously, some kind of festivity and ceremony. And there are kangaroos and other animals, and they're actually almost in a celebratory motion. It's just beautiful and stunning art, extraordinarily well preserved. But
did you know it was there?
No, I didn't. Some of the art had been recorded, extremely well recorded, but as usual, if you push out further and do 10-15 kilometre walks and look at some of the more remote areas systematically, and sometimes that can be quite, you know, you don't get much, but other times you have phenomenal hotspots, as we call them. And in that particular area, there was a huge area of white sand that was washed out by the river and created this massive occupation site, and you can see artefacts all over it. And so we're not just focusing on the art, we're interested in how art comes off the rocks and how people symbolically use their landscape. And so we might look at an occupation site nearby out in the open to see what sort of ochres and grinding and materials accompany those sorts of large aggregations. And we've found some extraordinary sites there that have metres and metres of deposit, which we, you know, conservatively believe will be older than 30,000 to 40,000. And they show quite significant changes in the artefacts through time, including things like quartz crystals being associated with the Wandjina sites.
Wow.
This was well recorded by the Frobenius expeditions, but it's never been found in what we call a stratified or buried context. So these are really quite remarkable records, which we can now take, as I say, from the symbolic and other artistic traditions off the rocks and then compare to the art and make it part of a cultural landscape. These are not paintings in the museum. This is part of, as you've said before, a living and maintained landscape. But so it was 20,000, 30,000 years ago.
Peter, we have to sort of finish up, which is a shame because I'd love to keep talking. But before I let you go and finish unpacking the car as you limp out of the house, let me just ask you to tell the story about the archaic faces.
Okay. Look, there's actually a lot of engraving, or what people call petroglyphs or carvings, across the Kimberley, and these are actually fairly underreported. And during the first week or so of the trip, a colleague, a filmmaker and Indigenous rangers from Punalulu got in touch and mentioned that there were some human faces, or archaic faces, as we call them, right up on the cliff face in the park. So we went there and did some recording and filming.
This is engraved, I take it. Are they engraved into the stone? Are they?
Into the rock. And they were 5 to 8 to 10 metres above the current surface. They're large, human-like faces. They had bodies, and they are just quite extraordinary. But what really struck me was the fact that there are not dissimilar ones over in the Victoria River District, which were recorded again back in the 1980s.
Which is literally thousands of kilometres to the east.
Well, it's certainly well over 500. And then down to the south of the Burrup Peninsula, Murujuga, the Dampier Archipelago, there are probably over 100 archaic faces.
Right.
Different, but the same. And so you start to join the dots and you think, okay, there were these really large traditions of depicting early human or mythological totemic forms across northern Australia, and guess what? They're into the Kimberley as well. So we really do need to look at both the engraved, the painted, the stone arrangements, the modified landscape, which is the cultural legacy of the first Australians, and it's extraordinary.
Peter, thank you for painting such a wonderful picture of what is obviously the first forays into a much more extensive, you know, I think you mentioned 5-year kind of circuit of research and discovery. I hope your leg feels better soon so you can get out there again, and more power to both your legs and your arm and your brain. Thank you very much indeed.
Thanks, Michael.
It's been great. Professor Peter Veth, who is the Kimberley Foundation Ian Potter Chair in Rock Art and a Professor of Archaeology at the University of Western Australia. And you can tell by my voice that I turn into a little boy when I hear these kind of discoveries. I just find it so exciting. And I hope you did share in some of that excitement as well.